I'm not going to talk about the new today. I'm going to talk about the old. So some of you will be disappointed. This is not a discovery of various new poets or new artists, but a reconsideration of the fate of modernism as I see it happening now, which is, though, a big change from what it was about a decade ago. Bear with me. Okay, the aura of modernism. In a discussion of Walter Benjamin's famous work of art in an age of mechanical reproducibility, Andreas Huysen, the critic, writes, "In the context of social and cultural theory, Benjamin conceptualized what Marcel Duchamp had already shown in 1919 in Elle à chaux au cul. Elle à chaux au cul is the Mona Lisa with the mustache, with the dirty French under it, Elle à chaux au cul, often translated into French as she has, into English as she has hot pants. It's not quite a translation either. By iconoclastically altering a reproduction of the Mona Lisa and by exhibiting a mass-produced urinal as a fountain sculpture, Duchamp succeeded in destroying what Benjamin called the traditional artwork's aura, that aura of authenticity and uniqueness that constituted the work's distance from life and that required contemplation and immersion on the part of the spectator." Duchamp against auratic art, against the unique art object, that's the sort of cliche of Duchamp criticism anyway. He certainly professed to be, but almost a century after Duchamp made Fountain is the urinal called Fountain, and Elle à chaux au cul, these ready-mades are enshrined in the Philadelphia Museum in a room of their own where pilgrims from around the world may be found in quiet contemplation of the artist's bold and unique conception. Indeed, the countless photographic reproductions, far from diminishing the aura of these originals, most of them not originals at all, but Duchamp's own later copies, seem only to have enhanced it. Duchamp's ready-mades now command sky-high prices, and when I recently applied for permission to reproduce these and related images in a scholarly book on modernism, 21st century modernism, I was charged more than $200 a piece, so much for no aura for that. Chronologically, Duchamp was, of course, an artist of the modernist era, Fountain dating from 1917. As a modernist, he was part of a larger movement that is now undergoing an astonishing revival. Duchamp exhibitions, conferences, websites, books, and articles are a boom industry. But so is the high modernism Duchamp ostensibly deconstructed in his experimental art. Consider the following events in 2003 and 4 alone. One, the Library of America, which is like our Pléiade, which are editions not for scholars, but for the general reader. The Library of America published Ezra Pound's Poems and Translations, a volume of nearly 1,400 pages that does not include the poet's central work, The Cantos, presumably because that will get a volume of its own. Its editor, Richard Seaberth, has also just brought out a superb annotated edition of the piece in Cantos for New Directions. No longer, evidently, will a selected Cantos do. The piece, as it is assumed, must and will be read whole in courses as well as by Pound readers at large. Two, the Cambridge edition of the Letters and Works of D.H. Lawrence, now running to some 40 volumes, has published a 700-page edition of Studies in Classic American Literature that supplements the short 1923 text most of us read long ago in a small Viking paperback. The Cambridge edition includes all the earlier versions of studies, drafts, and very full notes and introductory material. Three, the second volume of R.N. Foster's magisterial biography of W.B. Yeats, and I recommend that to you. That's just an incredible book, which I always am sad, though, that I still haven't finished it because I can't carry it around on planes because they're so fat, these books, but it's quite wonderful. Was published by Oxford, receiving many reviews like the following by John Banville in the New York Review of Books. W.B. Yeats' A Life is a great and important work, a triumph of scholarship, thought, and empathy, such as one would hardly have thought possible in this age of disillusion. It is an achievement wholly of a scale with its heroic subject. You wouldn't have read that kind of thing, I'd say, even 10 years ago, and we can talk about that later. Four, Gertrude Stein's writings, long considered too eccentric and incomprehensible to discuss in detail, are the subject of Ulla Dido's 600-page study, The Language That Rises from Northwestern, which examines the process of making and remaking of Stein's texts as they move from notepad to notebook to manuscript, focusing on a single decade, 1923-34. Dido's book lays to rest once and for all the myth regurgitated in Janet Malcolm's long New Yorker profile recently that Stein's colorful persona deserves discussion, but that with the exception of the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas and one or two other prose texts, the work itself is unreadable. 5. The University of Connecticut, just a few months ago, organized a large conference called Celebrating Wallace Stevens to be held in April 2004 and including poets as well as academics. A call for papers to supplement those by invited speakers produced, according to the organizer, Glenn McLeod, hundreds of submissions from eager young modernists. 6. Joseph Roth's The Radetzky March, 1932, newly translated by Joachim Neugroschel for Overlook Press in 2002, has become, after decades of neglect, something of a bestseller. In The New Yorker of 19th January 2004, Joan Acocella devotes a large portion of her essay, Rediscovering Joseph Roth, to this great novel of the decline of the Habsburg Empire, as seen through the eyes of its military, stationed in the small garrison border towns on the eastern frontier. What makes Roth so unusual, and no doubt accounts for his earlier neglect, is that this Jewish writer from Galicia, from Eastern Europe, was a fervent admirer of the monarchy, notably of the Emperor Franz Josef. And that's so un-PC that, you know, for years one couldn't quite stomach that, because he was not supposed to feel that way. That just doesn't seem to make any sense. 7th, in 2003, Viking published Lydia Davis's new translation of Du Côté de chez Swann by Proust, with the remaining volumes of A la recherche du temps perdu to come in translations by different authors. Widely reviewed in newspapers and magazines, this, perhaps the most difficult of modernist novels, is evidently selling astonishingly well to what is largely a new, younger audience. In Search of Lost Time, or Remembrance of Things Past, as it used to be called, in the Scott Moncrief translation, is the subject of 69 customer reviews on Amazon.com, of which more later. I'm going to be talking a lot about Amazon.com tonight. 8, the journal Modernism Modernity, and Jessica Burstein, who's in the English department here, was for a long time the managing editor of that, now in its 10th year of publication, won this year's Phoenix Award for Significant Editorial Achievement. Modernism Modernity is the official journal of the Modernist Studies Association, the MSA, which held its first annual convention in 1999 and is now a major fixture on the conference scene, having grown so large it can hardly accommodate all those who wish to attend and give papers. In 2003, the MSA put out a call for papers for a special double issue on a topic that would have been declared reactionary a mere decade ago, namely the poetry and prose of T.S. Eliot. Now, these are just random examples of modernist activity on the academic and publishing front today. It can be argued, of course, that the great artists of the early century never disappeared, that what we're witnessing today is more accurately survival rather than revival. Throughout the past century, they have always been scholars, poets, and even general readers committed to Yeats and Eliot, Pound and Stevens, Proust and Lawrence, and who were passionate about the avant-garde as represented by Duchamp and Gertrude Stein. But the fact is that from the 1960s, well into the 90s, the word modernism was a term of opprobrium. Even as the avant-garde was pronounced a failure, given its inability, so Peter Berger famously told us, to destroy art as a bourgeois institution. The critique of modernism, for that matter, came not only from the left, that questions its elitist, patriarchal, imperialist, and colonialist tendencies, but could be found in such bourgeois venues as The New Yorker, where Cynthia Ozick first published her scathing piece on T.S. Eliot. We no longer live, Ozick declared, in the literary shadow of Eliot, whom she dismissed as so much false coinage, an autocratic, inhibited, depressed, rather narrow-minded, and considerably bigoted fake Englishman. Pretty bad. High art, said Ozick, is dead. The passion for inheritance is dead. Tradition is equated with obscurantism. The wall that divided serious high culture from the popular arts is breached. In this context, quote, Eliot's elegiac fragments appear too arcane, too aristocratic, and too difficult for contemporary ambition. Now that essay appeared in 1989, a mere 15 years ago. Extreme as Ozick's argument may seem today, its reservations about Eliot's politics were voiced as early as 1967 by a critic who has himself written sympathetically on Eliot and edited his critical prose. I'm thinking of Frank Kermode, now Sir Frank Kermode, who observed in The Sense of an Ending that there was a correlation between early modernist literature and authoritarian politics, and he was one of the first to make that accusation, that totalitarian theories of form, which he found in such key texts as Yeats's A Vision, Eliot's critical essays, and everywhere in Pound's writings, were matched or reflected by a totalitarian politics. And Kermode wrote, it appears, in fact, that modernist radicalism in art, the breaking down of pseudo-traditions, the making new of a true understanding of the nature of the elements of art. This radicalism involves the creation of fictions which may be dangerous in the dispositions they breed toward the world. Instead of a commonplace view of reality, there is to be order as the modernist artist understands it, rigid, out of flux, the spatial order of the modern critic or the closed authoritarian society. And Kermode singled out Eliot as the most extreme case of such authoritarianism. Quote, he had a persistent nostalgia for closed, immobile, hierarchical societies. If tradition is, as he said in After Strange Gods, the habitual actions, habits, customs, which represent the kinship of the same people living in the same place, shades of Bloom's ineffectual definition of a nation in Ulysses, it is clear that Jews do not have it, but also that practically nobody now does. Now that's certainly an accurate appraisal of After Strange Gods, the set of University of Virginia lectures Eliot published in 1938 and then suppressed because he realized he shouldn't have said the things he did. This is the notorious set of lectures where Eliot said in 1938, we don't want too many free-thinking Jews about, and then everybody tried to excuse that on various grounds and of course couldn't really. But Kermode makes two assumptions that now seem questionable. First, his modernism here refers to the later 1930s. Indeed, early modernism is Kermode's term for the pre-World War II period, as distinct from what he calls the schismatic modernism of the post-war era. But from the vantage point of the 21st century, we may note, as have recent critics like Tyrus Miller and Peter Nichols, that modernism was a phenomenon of the early century. Indeed, Nichols follows Benjamin in taking the modernist ethos back to the 19th century, the mid-19th century of Baudelaire. Considers Baudelaire the first modernism, which Benjamin did too, which is actually, I think, probably the right way to go. The totalitarianisms of the 30s, communism as well as fascism, worked to undermine the very foundations of modernism, as we can see most clearly in the Soviet rejection of its own avant-garde, emblemized dramatically by the suicide of Mayakovsky in 1930. That particular moment, and that sort of Stalinist moment, is often taken as that, and that certainly by that point, you sort of feel modernism, as we knew it, was over. Periodization is, of course, always open to debate, but what about Kermode's other unstated assumption, which is that the totalitarian politics of much Anglo-American modernist writing was matched by totalitarian form, he says, the rigid spatial order of a closed authoritarian society. Do such strictures, in fact, apply to the paratactic collage structure of Pound's Cantos, to the freewheeling performative mode of Lawrence's studies in classic American literature, to the non-linear narratives of Stein's Tender Buttons or Stanzas in Meditation, to the pseudo-closure of The Wasteland's final line, Shanti, 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 the piece that passes understanding, which succeeds only in reopening the larger question of what it might mean to fish with the arid plain behind me. These are questions that seem vital enough to readers of modernist texts today. But in the antinomian climate of the 1960s, Kermode's association of modernism with reaction, authoritarianism, and proto-fascism found a sympathetic audience. The rescue operation performed by Adorno's aesthetic theory, published in 1970, had not yet begun. Indeed, in the English-speaking world, I'm sorry, the German edition in 1970, indeed, in the English-speaking world, the reception of this important text did not begin properly until at least 1984, when the first English translation of the book was published by Routledge. For Adorno, modernist art is characterized by its resistance to capitalist commodification, a resistance characterized by its opposition to a society that it nevertheless brings back into the artwork by means of indirect critique. The true modernist artwork, Adorno posits, refuses to engage in direct reflection of social surface. It does not want to duplicate the facade of reality, but makes an uncompromising reprint of reality while at the same time avoiding being contaminated by it. This dialectic process is characterized by Adorno, famously, as negative mimesis. Kafka's work, for example, is great in its negative sense of reality. His image of bureaucracy is the cryptogram of capitalism's highly polished, glittering late phase, which he excludes in order to define it all the more precisely in its negative, says Adorno. Accordingly, fragmentation, dislocation, and difficulty are essential to modernist art, which rigidly excludes the banalities of everyday life and rejects the specious productions of mass culture. And that's where we stood sort of with that kind of Adorno moment. Marxist critics, as dissimilar as Andreas Huyssen and Frederick Jameson, have built on Adorno's theory, even as they have rejected its purism, its repudiation of all but self-evidently high art into the modernist canon, so that even jazz has been dismissed by Adorno as merely populist. In After the Great Divide, 1986, Huysen takes as his starting point Adorno's characterization of modernism as insisting on the autonomy of the artwork, its obsessive hostility to mass culture, its radical separation from the culture of everyday life, and its programmatic distance from political, economic, social concerns. But whereas Adorno considers such distance inevitable, Huysen argues that the task of postmodernism has been precisely to challenge the great divide between high art and mass culture, and this is a very familiar argument, I'm sure most of you know. Examining a variety of postmodern art discourses, Huysen notes that the pedestal of high art and high culture no longer occupies the privileged space it used to. Despite all its noble aspirations and achievements, we have come to recognize that the culture of enlightened modernity has also always, though by no means exclusively, been a culture of inner and outer imperialism, an imperialism that no longer goes unchallenged. Whether these challenges, Huysen concludes, will usher in a more habitable, less violent, and more democratic world remains to be seen. Now, Frederick Jameson's critique of Adorno's aesthetics is even more pessimistic. For Jameson, modernist resistance cannot, as Adorno posits, overcome the terrible alienation that defines the modernist period. The increasing commodification of social relations, the degradation of language at the hands of advertising, the impersonality and anonymity of bureaucracy, these create a literature, he argues, that is increasingly embattled. The battle cry, "Make it new," in this context, is no more than a doomed effort to resist capitalist reification. The dislocation of modernist narrative, moreover, can be understood as a denial of historical change. Postmodernism, which represents an even further stage of what is now global capitalism, cannot improve this state of affairs, but at least its admission that depth has given way to surface, parody to pastiche, emotion to a new blank affect, a centered discourse to one that is wholly decentered, exposes the limitations of modernism. Indeed, the seemingly realist fiction of emerging nations, old-fashioned as it may look to those with modernist blinkers, Jameson now argues, manifests an authenticity lost in the Western world, an authenticity that comes from its allegorical treatment of its respective culture. Accordingly, so Jameson argues in his famous postmodernism essay, the first essay in Postmodernism, the Cultural Logic of Late Capitalism, and also in his conclusion, which comes later, the high modernist conception of a unique style, along with the accompanying collective ideals of an artistic or political vanguard or avant-garde, themselves stand or fall along with that older notion of experience of the so-called centered subject. And there's much talk in the pages that follow of the demise of the bourgeois ego, of the distinctive brushstroke, of a self present to do the feeling. And this became, this of course is deconstructionist theory, but it became a kind of truism. There's no self, there's no ego, no coherent anything, and so on. There's no self present to do the feeling. Modernism, it seems, therefore, can no longer speak to us. Thus, in his conclusion, Jameson raises questions like, is T.S. Eliot recuperable? I'm going to try to prove to you that, you know, that's sort of silly question anyway. Is T.S. Eliot recuperable? Or whatever happened to Thomas Mann or André Gide? Franklin Trichia, he posits, has kept Wallace Stevens alive throughout this momentous climatological transformation, but Paul Valéry has vanished without a trace, and he was central to the modernist movement internationally. Indeed, the great modernist works, he says, have become reified by becoming school classics. Their distance from their readers as monuments and as the efforts of genius tended also to paralyze form production in general, to endow the practice of all the high cultural arts with an alienating specialist or expert qualification that blocked the creative mind with awkward self-consciousness and intimidated fresh production. Now, this was written or rather published in 1991, a short 13 years ago. All the more astonishing, therefore, how fully Jameson's theory of modernism has lost ground. And this used to be quoted as if it were simply the truth. Parody gives way to pastiche, the ego gives way to the dissociated self. It was just sort of a like a mantra for in courses on modernism and so on. More recent cultural critics like Michael North, Jennifer Wick, and Carrie Nolan have been at pains to show that far from excluding all popular culture and the realm of everyday life, the great modernist works like Ulysses, or avant-garde poems like Blaise Andra's Pose du Temps Sibérien, were permeated with the language of advertising and commerce, that the great divide at any rate was always more apparent than real. And in the futurist class I attended today here, certainly that point is made very clearly. It was never really true anyway. In reading 1922, Michael North concludes that beginning with Wittgenstein, whose Tractatus was published in England in 1922, along with Ulysses and the Wasteland, the notion that truth is local in particular came into being as a reflex of the attempt to make it global and universal. Modernism, by this argument, was never accurately characterized by the autonomy and elitism attributed to it. It was always thoroughly contaminated by its rapprochement with the discourses of everyday life. And not just in the case of the more obvious things like, let's say, the futurist evenings of performance art, but even in the major figures as well, certainly in a figure like Choice. Such reconsideration of modernist text, and indeed the whole complex discourse about the relation of the 20th century art to mass culture, has done much to prompt a lively new discussion of modernism in academic venues and scholarly journals. But the revival of modernism has also been promoted by another and rather more unlikely quarter, namely the broader English-speaking public that communicates on the internet, particularly in such places as the customer review columns of Amazon.com. Customer reviewers, who may or may not give their names in whole or in part, but do provide their locations, for example, Adriana from Viña del Mar, Chile, or Tepi from Kyoto, Japan, or Arita from San Francisco, and they have to have verifiable, though unpublished, email addresses, come from all over the world and remain largely anonymous with respect to age, race, business or profession, social class, and often, as in the case of Tepi, even gender. They need not purchase the book in question, and they receive no reward other than that of finding their statements, ranging from a single sentence to a page or two, reproduced online together with their rankings from 5 stars, that's the top, down to 1 or none. What motivates customer reviewers, it would seem, is the invitation to make their voices and rankings heard by others. Now, recently, I don't know whether you all saw this, there was an article in the New York Times, after I wrote this actually, and in the Washington Post, saying that, no, the customer reviewers who work on contemporary things are often the wives or husbands of novelists who are just pushing their work, and that this is all very corrupt and maybe should stop. Now, that may or may not be true. After all, you can only write, though, one of these reviews. That may or may not be true when you're dealing with the latest novel that comes out or so on, but you certainly don't get too many brownie points for writing about Eliot or Conrad or so forth. I mean, from whom? Whom are you going to get these brownie points from? Judging from their frequently faulty grammar and spelling, and I'm going to give you some examples of that, these are not likely to be professionals or even students. I'm assuming students spell well right here. Although they're generally well-informed and highly literate. Rather, they represent a situation Walter Benjamin anticipated when he remarked wistfully that in the age of mechanical reproducibility, at any moment the reader is likely to turn into a writer. And he said, and this is so long ago, it was so prescient, it began with the daily press opening to its readers space for letters to the editor. And today there's hardly a gainfully occupied European, this was 1937, who could not in principle find an opportunity to publish somewhere or other comments on his work, grievances, documentary reports. Thus the distinction between author and public is about to lose its basic character. Now these words have proved to be remarkably prophetic. When Jameson asks, is Eliot recuperable? He's referring to the academic consensus of the 1980s and 90s, when the very intimation of anti-Semitism, racism, colonialism was enough to keep a given author out of the literature classroom. But there are signs that this consensus is breaking down. In 1998, Signet Books published a mass market paperback of The Wasteland, and with an introduction by Helen Bendler. In 2000, Norton published the Norton Critical Edition of The Wasteland, edited by Michael North. Together, these two editions have received about 30 customer reviews, almost all of them granting Eliot 5 stars, and I must quote some of them to you because they're so priceless, really. Here's one by Cal Each from Georgia, USA, What the Thunder Said, April 9th, 2001. T.S. Eliot wrote The Wasteland against the backdrop of a world gone mad, searching for reason inside chaos and striving to build an arc of words by which future generations could learn what had gone before. T.S. Eliot explores the greatest of human melancholy, disillusionment. This is a difficult poem, but one well worth exploring to its fullest. The inherent rhythms of Eliot's speech, the delightful, though sometimes obscure, allusions. I don't think we usually think of those allusions as being delightful. I think that's sort of a funny phrase. Anyway, an intricate word craft create an atmosphere of civilization on the edge, in danger of forgetting its past and therefore repeating it. And it goes on this way for a while, and then buy this, you won't regret it. If you're an Eliot fan, you probably have it anyway. If you're not, you will be when you put it down. All right, that's one. The second one I have here is Angelo Ventura from Brescia, Lombardia, Italy. Search for Your Soul, May 12, 2003. He's the one and only poet of modern man's soul. All modern literature owes to him. Not only this, but he had great imagination and a wry sense of humor. Not only that. Great. Among his minor works, sonnets like The Hippopotamus is worth a poem by any other modern writer. Read him to inspire your mind. And then here's one called, the acronym this person has is I Buried Paul, from Clearwater, Florida. December 20th, 2001. Simply put, The Wasteland is one of the strangest, most complicated, and interesting poems ever written. Try reading an unannotated version of the poem, and you will see why even T.S. Eliot scholars need a little help with some of the images and literary references Eliot uses. The Norton Critical Edition is an essential book for any Eliot fan, new or old. It provides you with practically every single piece of literature, history, and music that inspired Eliot to write his manifesto of the lost generation. If you have any questions concerning The Wasteland, this is the book you need, this is the book you want. Buy it and realize how well-read you are not. And finally, I won't go on all these Eliot things, here's one by Eric Tennyson from Philadelphia, January 11, 2004, so just recently. Simply stated, this poem is one of the true benchmarks for 20th century literature. It is rather difficult in that it is highly elusive. Some allusions fall on the rather obscure side, Middleton, Weston, but most are rather well known, Augustine, Dante, the Bible, Baudelaire, Wagner. The experience will prove to be as didactic as well as expressive due to all these allusions in the text. As far as the poem itself goes, it has a definite effect on you when you read it. I remember the first time I read the lines, "I think we are in Rat's Alley, where the dead men lost their bones." And although I couldn't really understand what was going on in the poem, that line, as well as many other lines and images, had an affect on me. It should be an affect on me. On the whole, the emotional tone of the poem, not to do it injustice and say what it's about, is the spiritual alienation and degradation everyone felt after World War I. It's a quest of sorts, and it goes on a little bit more in that vein. Now, I suppose Jameson might respond that these customer reviews testify to the thorough commodification of The Wasteland, what with their naive enthusiasm and assessment of Eliot's subject matter. But I would argue that this sheer enthusiasm on the part of non-academic readers who have nothing to gain from writing their commentaries tells us something very different. When Eric Tennyson, for example, talks of the amazing emotional high he received from the lines, "I think we're in Rat's Alley, where the dead men lost their bones," he's saying, however naively, that poetry is first of all a use of sound and language. At the same time, all the readers of North's Norton Critical Edition testify to wanting to know more about this poem they already love. North himself posits in reading 1922 that The Wasteland shares a discourse radius with any number of other works produced in the same year, works in different genres like Anja Jezerska's Jewish immigrant novel, Salome of the Tenements, or Walter Lippmann's essay, Public Opinion. That's true if we're reading The Wasteland as an index to the culture and ideology that produced it. But why do readers whose knowledge of and interest in post-World War I London, as seen through the eyes of an American expatriate, are likely to be minimal? Readers who, by their own admission, have never heard of most of the authors alluded to in The Wasteland continue to find the poem so fascinating. It seems that what readers look for is not the poem's political unconscious, but the charm of its distinctive rhythm and its deployment of a language that is somehow extraordinary. It must, in short, give pleasure. Now take the case of the American communist poet, Edwin Rolfe, whose dates were 1909 to 54, who is allotted 12 pages in Carrie Nelson's Anthology of Modern American Poetry, which came out from Oxford in 2000, and receives thorough treatment on the website that accompanies the volume. Rolfe's Trees Become Torches selected poems, published in the American Poetry Recovery Series at the University of Illinois Press in 1994, followed by the collected poems in 1997, must now be special ordered on Amazon.com because its sales rank is too low. In other words, however you try to push it and say, oh, we've got to start reading these things, that is not going to go over with the general public. And there is a general public, although, you know, people keep thinking it no longer exists. There are always these arguments about it. For Nelson and his fellow editors, Rolfe's political poems, especially those prompted by the Spanish Civil War and later by McCarthyism, are important as fiery denunciations of capitalism and class stratification. But radical politics per se evidently has little appeal to the internet poetry audience. The Rolfe volumes have not prompted a single customer review, whereas this poet's exact contemporary, George Oppen, himself a communist in the pre-World War II years, receives comments like the following, and I was actually surprised that Oppen got this much attention. Here's Aaron Peck from Vancouver. Neglected classic, March 31st, 2000. Oppen is by far the most underrated poetic genius of the 20th century. I know that sounds bold, but I think for the most part, his work has been suppressed because of his unapologetic affiliations with the Communist Party. His work, however, is not concerned with politics. It is some of the most honest, personal, and striking poetry I've read in this language. His long poem of Being Numerous is the greatest example. And he quotes, obsessed, bewildered by the shipwreck of the singular, we have chosen the meaning of being numerous. And those of you who don't know that poem, of being numerous, long poem by Oppen, that is one of a quite amazing and moving poem. Oppen is the great, this is still part of the review, Oppen is the great forgotten elegist of the post-war era. These poems are in a sense about failure, about loss, and how we perceive and react to the world. The book is not to be missed, as it far too often is. And another review, this one by L.J. from Los Angeles, December 5th, 2000. I don't know much about George Oppen, except to note in passing that he was among those victimized by the anti-communist hysteria of the 50s. But he has just become one of my favorite poets for having produced this sleek little volume, and that was this in which, one of the earlier volumes. The poems here are extremely terse and rock-like. Every word is carefully chosen, and the result is verse of uncommon force and directness. Not many poets can say so much with so little. From the title poem, You Are the Last Who Will Know Him, Nurse. Not know him. He is an old man, a patient. How could one know him? You are the last who will see him or touch him, nurse. If you're like me and have had your share of chatty or self-consciously clever wordsmiths, this is strong stuff. Oppen's chilly Spartan poetry sounds like it should be chiseled in stone, and he can be winning even when he departs from form, as proven by the prose sections in Root. It's intense, haunting, and truly memorable, and I mean this last adjective literally. I can remember this stuff after I've put the book down, whereas most poetry disintegrates in my head almost instantly. This is the real thing, people, and you owe it to yourself to find a copy. And that was for a book that was out of print, actually, that he reviewed at this length, and I found that quite surprising. Now, what makes these Oppen reviews written before the 2002 publication of Michael Davidson's new collected poems remarkable is that the customers in question are calling attention to long since published or out of print books of poems, books that are here praised for their language, the integrity of their form, and their creation of a distinctive lyric speaker. Amazon reviewers, in other words, instinctively look for works that strike them as unique, that have what Benjamin called aura. The response to Gertrude Stein is especially interesting in this regard. For the past decade or so, academic criticism has emphasized Stein's representativeness. Stein the feminist, Harriet Chessman, the lesbian writer, Judy Grahn, the expatriate, Sherry Benstock, different scholars, the American immigrant, Priscilla Wald, the trained scientist, Stephen Meyer, the collector-consumer, Michael Davidson, the Jew, Maria Damon. Most recently in Janet Malcolm's New Yorker profile, Stein the proto-fascist who wrote speeches for Marshal Petain, she did, and protected the politically suspect Bernard Fay. Now, all these studies provide valuable insights into Stein's work, but they also make apparent that hers is a work that never quite fits the proposed category. In the Oxford Anthology of Modern American Poetry, for example, Nelson includes only a single Stein work, Patriarchal Poetry, so as to bring her into the feminist fold, but this long, linguistically dislocated poem can hardly live up to its fighting title. I'm convinced he never really read it. He didn't read the poem, because if he had, he'd realize that although it has that title, Patriarchal Poetry, it doesn't fit neatly into any kind of argument of that sort, and that's the only one he included. Now, the one thing, though, that Stein inevitably was, both chronologically and geographically, an American in Paris, was a modernist. Ulla Dido's The Language That Rises, which documents Stein's process of revision, her obsessive care for le mot juste, the right sentence, and the perfection of composition and formal structure, allies this Jamesian, both Henry and William were central influences, writer to such otherwise uncongenial modernists as Eliot and Pound. The Amazon.com reviewer seemed to recognize this. The mass-produced Dover edition, 1997, of Tender Buttons, elicited many reviews, of which I'll just quote a few. Modernist classic that's fun to read, October 9th, 2002, Michael Helsum, Dallas, Texas. The playfulness and intellectual rigor of the best of the modernist movement unite in this small book of exquisite prose poems that may be read on one level at least as an extended allegory of eroticism, tender buttons or nipples, and on another as a manifesto of what was to become language poetry. But you don't really need to be a scholar to appreciate the freshness and lovely rhythms of the poems. They are like nothing else that existed at the time they were written. Not even the great Victorian nonsense poets dared to be this non-referential. And though they have cast a long shadow across the late 20th century, POMO, postmodernism, there really has been nothing like them since. And here's one I really like, by Mikkel from Ardmore, PA, January 17th, 2002. I gave this book to my six-year-old nephew when he was starting to read. Boy, did he get annoyed. But he kept coming back to it. "These are not poems," he would sputter. While Finnegan's Wake is supposed to be difficult to comprehend, one can diagram Joyce's sentences. The grammar is normative. Only the words are peculiar. With Stein, the words themselves are normal, even banal. But the sentences are more out there than a Zen koan. Anyway, as the late lamented Beetle George supposedly said about a painting, it's either groovy or it isn't. Tender Buttons is. So, there it is. Tell the students. And then here's one from Portland, Oregon. Endlessly readable, the best prose poem of all time. Endlessly rereadable. I don't have as much patience as some with Stein's other work, but Tender Buttons is sublime. It leads the mind down paths it would not otherwise follow. I'm basically a Philistine and a populist, but this book never loses its splendor. Here and here only for me, Gertrude Stein has perfect pitch. And then this last one, which is especially funny, Pure Utter Genuineness, March 19th, 2000, Pauline from Brussels, Belgium. My random poems have been said to be Stein-like. Now that I know more about GS, a poem was inspired by her, Gertrude Stein poem, Oh My Gin. Images realize aspects throughout. This is her poem. Painting daunting, solid, reasonable, feisty planes of aura felt. Pangs of fluid energy suffer thought. Remaining understood eras feel wrought over and through. Satisfied mental strain tally connective ways again. Palled sorts of sloughs, oh mirage, onslaught of papyrus. Well, Zen Cohen, perfect pitch, freshness, lovely rhythms, and as Pauline from Brussels puts it in her Stein poem, feisty planes of aura felt. Now let's return to that aura felt and try to sketch in why I think modernism does exert such power over us today. And this next section is called News, It's Day's News, from Ezra Pound. Poetry, Pound famously declared in the ABC of Reading, is news that stays news. It's a sobering reminder in the age of cell phones, emails, blogs, and countless websites that make demands on our daily attention. Nothing seems to last more than a split second, even the appearances of our favorite poets and artists. We spot an Ashbery poem in the TLS or the New York Review of Books. We tell ourselves we'll catch it later when we have more time. And that, in any case, it will surely appear in the poet's next collection. But such delay is tricky, for by then it may be a somewhat different poem. In a recent essay already in proof, I cited two new poetic texts by the British multimedia poet Carolyn Bergwall, only to have the poet send me a newer version of the manuscript whose changes I wish I could have incorporated into my citations. She keeps changing it and sending me new versions, and they're published someplace else, so you really can't keep up, and texts no longer have that, you know, kind of durability. Change, it would seem, is all, and those who succeed are those willing to reinvent themselves gracefully. As little as two decades ago, when theorists like Michel Foucault or Paul Demand were holding sway, a given position could be counted on to have a lifespan of at least 6 or 7 years, roughly the time it took to complete one's PhD. Today, there is no such continuity. Those, for example, who did American studies a decade ago, when it was fashionable to produce books with titles like Constituting Americans, that's Priscilla Wald's 1995 book, I cited in connection to Stein, have now moved on to globalization studies, where Americans are now constituted in terms of a very different picture, and literary texts have become expendable. Interdisciplinarity, the watchword of the moment, often means non rather than inter. Consider our current political paradigm, where the worst thing one can say, I wrote this a few months ago when there were the various Democratic candidates, about any presidential candidate is that he's an insider. As if training in political history and theory, constitutional law, economics, and just plain political practice means nothing. So the bodybuilder turned film star and producer Arnold Schwarzenegger and the physician Howard Dean boast that at least they're not insiders, like Gray Davis or John Kerry. The reverse is also the case. I recently read that Gray Davis is now acting in a film comedy. Gray Davis won't mean much to all of you. Gray Davis was our governor in California. Controversial. And although I don't know of any politicians who've become physicians overnight, I predict this too will happen. It will happen. Certainly Richard Dysart, who happens to be a friend of mine, who played the avuncular senior partner in the TV series L.A. Law, is known for the astute legal commentary he dispenses at cocktail parties. You can't appreciate how funny that is. You run into Richard Dysart, who just played that senior partner. It's not really a very important part. And he'll start explaining law cases to you and tell you, and you start believing, well, sure, he knows, right? He acts the part. And so this is how we react to these things here. Again, no one seems to think it odd that Slavoj Žižek would produce a new reading of Christianity, The Puppet and the Dwarf, which came out in 2003 from MIT Press, or that Giovanna Borradori's interviews with Jürgen Habermas and Jacques Derrida on the occasion of 9/11 would generate a book called Philosophy in a Time of Terror, Chicago 2003. And one wonders what the staying power of such books will be. Are they designed to be read 5 years from now? And if not, what's the difference between philosophy in the Habermas Derrida title in journalism? How can you crank out philosophy that quickly after 9/11? So it does make you wonder. The situation in scholarship is not entirely different. Consider Jerome McGann's encyclopedic and brilliantly produced Dante Gabriel Rossetti hypertext archive, copyrighted in 1993 in its first incarnation and constructed in stages, the most recent installment dating from 2000. The archive will soon need extensive reconstruction so as to be up to date as well as easier to access. That's the trouble with these archives. They have to be kept up to date, and that isn't so easy. But even as the project is launched to, you know, an awful lot of money, a nagging question arises: how many English departments at the present moment offer a course in Victorian poetry, much less the pre-Raphaelites? How many art history departments? And how, in turn, will the archive be able to create its audience rather than respond to an existing one? Now, in this climate, the traditional genres, poem, painting, novel, inevitably take a back seat to such intentionally transient art forms as performance, installation, sound sculpture, and what I've called elsewhere differential text, by which I mean a text, I've written about this elsewhere, that exists in various incarnations, like Kenneth Goldsmith's work that exists as if there's a print version, there's a digital version, and there may be an art gallery display, but there's no one text. So there isn't that text that you can pour over because things change. A Robert Smithson earthwork like the Spiral Jetty, or a Fluxus performance like George Brecht's famed Keyhole event, these are now known not in their original form, but through extensive documentation, photographic reproduction, and retrospective exhibition. And poems like those collected in, let's say, David Anton's Talking at the Boundaries of 1976 are known to younger audiences primarily through tape recordings available in the various poetry sound archives. An important intermediate artist like the Swedish Irvin Fahlström, whose radio plays of the 60s are only now getting the attention they deserve, is known to English-speaking readers mainly through such scholarly texts as Teddy Holtberg's Manipulating the World, 1999, which contains a complete text of Fahlström's Birds in Sweden and the Holy Torsten Nielsen, these two radio plays, together with CDs, synopses, critical analyses, and the concrete poetry version of specific radio dialogues. So reading thus increasingly gives way to a complex interactive process involving various technologies. It's in this context that modernism casts such a long shadow. For even as contemporary texts enjoy an inevitable precariousness, the great texts of the early century are very much there, showing no signs of going away. Indeed, all present indicators suggest that 100 years from now, people will still be reading Conrad's Heart of Darkness, Joyce's Ulysses, Kafka's The Trial, Mann's Death in Venice, even as museums, or whatever large exhibition spaces will be called 100 years from now, will still be showing Malevich's paintings and Duchamp's ready-mades. The question is why? Once when I was talking to John Cage, I mentioned that I didn't know how to approach the procedural texts of Jackson McCloe, poet-artist Jackson McCloe, that I didn't quite get their point. I didn't quite know how to deal with these strange texts. Jackson McCloe is now about 80 years old, but been around a long time. Oh, Cage laughed, forget about their quality, just think about their quantity. Nonsensical as this quip sounds, it says something important about the modernists. Theirs was the first and perhaps the last generation that combined a long lifespan and the production of voluminous works with the faith that, to cite Pound again, great literature is simply language charged with meaning to the utmost possible degree, that poetry is the most concentrated form of verbal expression. It's an unusual combination. Victorian careers also tended to be long and produced great quantities of poetry and prose. But no one would pretend that Tennyson, whose dates are 1809-92, or Browning, 1812-89, had loaded every rift with ore, to quote Keats, who himself died at the age of 22. But the modernists took very seriously Keats' pronouncement that the excellence of every art is in its intensity. It is all speech, Yeats once praised a poem by his friend Dorothy Wellesley, carried to its highest by intensity of sound and meaning. And he describes the demonic man of phase 17 in A Vision, which was Yeats's own phase, as one who seeks to deliver simplification through intensity, modified by simplicity. Use no superfluous word, wrote Pound, no adjective which does not reveal something. And again, this time with the Victorians and Edwardians squarely in mind, don't use such an expression as dim lands of peace. It dulls the image. And again, in the ABC of Reading, the famous line from Pound, Dichten, make poetry, equals condensare, condense. Except for Hart Crane, who committed suicide when he was 33, the major American modernist poets had long careers. Robert Frost lived to be 84, Stein, 72, Stevens, 76, William Carlos Williams, 75, Ezra Pound, 87, H.D., 75, Marion Moore, 85, T.S. Eliot, 77. All of the above produced volume after volume of poetry, but unlike so many of their postmodern successors, the modernists were prolific in other forms of writing as well. They were dramatists, like Stein, Williams, Pound, and Eliot, fiction writers, Stein, Williams, and H.D., critics, all of the above, but especially Eliot and Pound, autobiographers, Stein, Williams, translators, editors, essayists, and often, as in the case of such British modernists as Yeats, Lawrence, and Virginia Woolf, brilliant letter writers. Indeed, however complicated their love lives, or for Yeats and Pound, their misguided political actions, it's fair to say that writing is what these writers lived for. And not just topical writing, but the production of news that stays news. Writing, by this account, inevitably involved contradiction as well as complexity. Yeats especially, but also the very different Williams, used poetry as the site where contradictory views and emotions could be resolved, but only momentarily, making way for the production of the next poem. Density, in this scheme of things, is all. It's no coincidence, surely, that Wittgenstein, himself by no means sympathetic to his literary contemporaries in Britain, remarked in one of his Zettel, "Do not forget that a poem, although it is composed in the language of information, is not used in the language game of giving information." Nor is it a coincidence that the great Russian modernist theorist Roman Jakobson, who began his career as a futurist poet named Algirov, and wrote his first book on the avant-garde poet Vladimir Khlebnikov, insisted on the distinction between the poetic and the referential functions of language, a distinction that has, of course, come under heavy fire from critics like Stanley Fish, critics who have proved that one cannot pinpoint a hard and fast difference between, say, the language of journalism and the language of poetry. And of course you can't pinpoint a particular difference, which doesn't mean that there isn't any difference at all. But if there cannot and should not be a quantitative measure for such differentiation, any more than that there is a great divide between high and low art, common sense, and this is where Pound is such a central politician, tells us that writing that does not stay news is quickly expendable and replaceable by other writing. Only poetry, as he frequently put it, endures, and by poetry, though in the larger sense of art. Gertrude Stein, as I've argued elsewhere, held similar views. In What Are Masterpieces, 1935, she distinguishes between talking and writing, the former necessary for the creation of identity, the latter an act of creation, and she declares, "After all, there's always the same subject. There are the things you see, and there are human beings and animal beings, and everybody, you might say, since the beginning of time, knows practically, commencing at the beginning and going to the end, everything about these things. It is not this knowledge that makes masterpieces. Not at all, not at all, at all." Art for Stein has nothing to do with subject matter or psychology. How Hamlet reacts to his father's ghost, for instance, has nothing to do with the nature or value of Hamlet the play, she says. That would be something anyone in a village would know. They could talk about it endlessly, but that would not make a masterpiece. And the same holds true for painting. A picture exists, she says, for and in itself, and the painter has to use objects, landscapes, and people as a way, the only way, that he's able to get the picture to exist. Now here's the demand for autonomy, regularly attributed to such high modernists as Eliot and Pound, but rarely to an avant-gardist like Gertrude Stein. And this is where things get complicated, because the usual textbook version is, all right, the high modernists believed in autonomy, and that's a bad thing, but then we had other people who didn't. I'm not so sure there really was that division. The poet Thornton Wilder recalls her saying, has to work in the excitingness of pure being. He, and notice she uses he, has to get back that intensity into language. There's that word, intensity, again. And Stein always coupled intensity with the notion of work, as when in Picasso she characterized the painter as one who was always working, whereas others were following him. And as Wilder further recalls, Miss Stein once said, every masterpiece came into the world with a measure of ugliness in it. That ugliness is the sign of the creator's struggle to say a new thing in a new way, for an artist can never repeat yesterday's success. And after every great creator, there follows a second man who shows how it can be done easily. Picasso struggled and made this new thing, and then Braque came along and showed how it could be done without pain. And Gertrude Stein was always very hard on Braque. Struggle, innovation, greatness, genius. Like Pound, Stein distinguishes between the inventors and the diluters. Like Pound or Williams, Malevich or Mayakovsky, she assumes that the artist's duty is to make it new. Are these ideas right or wrong, as the narrator asks in Eliot's Portrait of a Lady? The question is irrelevant, for surely the aura of modernist art is that it was made by poets and painters, novelists and composers who cared so much. That however questionable their politics, their ideology, their racism and sexism, they were nothing if not humble when it came to their own work. It had to be right, and that meant constant struggle and revision. Lawrence, who rewrote rather than revised most of his novels and short stories, wrote four versions of even as relatively minor a text as his essay on Whitman before he was satisfied with it. And we talked yesterday in one of the sessions about how Duchamp, when he was replicating his boxes, he would go to 20 stationery stores in Paris to buy the kind of paper that he had originally used because it had to be right. And it's something that John Cage has done much more recently. It has to be done right. If it's supposed to be 30 seconds, it can't be 29. And there's that kind of care. The question for us then, and I don't have answers for this, it's really just a question, is what happens to the arts when they are no longer considered a big deal? If there is no great divide between art and mass culture, between high and low, if art discourse is just another discourse to be placed alongside some other cultural practice, like advertising, if indeed a given poet no longer plans on a collected poems, but seems content to replace each volume with another, newer one, so as to produce a string of works that may or may not be valuable in toto, the poet Clark Coolidge would be a case in point. I was discussing this with Jed Rasseler recently, and we were saying, when you have somebody who's written as much as Clark Coolidge, well, did you assign all those books? Do you want people to read all of them? Are you satisfied to read a representative one, a generic one, or what? You know, how does all that work? How does the audience process that poet's oeuvre? Do we read Coolidge wholesale, select one of his 30 or 40 small press books, and read it in the context of the jazz musicians who have inspired his work? For Adorno, the production of art in an age of capitalist commodification could only be an act of negative mimesis, a form of resistance. For more recent left criticism, even such resistance is no longer possible, and hence, the argument goes, it is high time to replace an aestheticist lit crit with a more useful and disinterested cultural history and theory, with a methodology of anthropology, whereby artworks and literary texts can be seen as so many cultural phenomena. And that is, of course, a very useful task. But, and this is where those Amazon.com reviews and related internet postings become telling, it seems that artworks refuse to go away. The new century is now witnessing, even as it did at the dawn of the 20th century, a renewed sense that art matters. And I guess that's the case I would want to make. If you're not going to take it seriously, you're not going to get very good art either. I mean, it can't really work that way. Poetry, as Charles Bernstein quips in A Poetics, should be at least as interesting as, and a whole lot more unexpected than television. And he questions Jameson's refusal to discriminate between the many possible responses to the productions of the present. And he says, failure to make such distinctions is similar to failing to distinguish between youth gangs, pacifist anarchists, weather people, anti-Sandinista contras, Salvadoran guerrillas, Islamic terrorists, or U.S. state terrorists. Perhaps all of these groups are responding to the same stage of multinational capitalism. But the crucial point is that the responses cannot be understood as the same, unified as various interrelated symptoms of late capitalism. The reception of art, in other words, must always factor in difference, as must its production. The real interest of modernist high art in the scheme of things is not that it can be understood as one of many cultural discourses, but that its own discourse is so complex, varied, and intense. Let me conclude with some recent assessments of one of Walter Benjamin's own favorites, Proust's great novel, A la recherche du temps perdu, now being retranslated. I found when I looked for this 69 readers' reviews of Proust's recherche on Amazon.com, almost all of them euphoric. Here's an assessment posted on January 21st, 2004, by a Swiss woman who read the Recherche in French but writes about it in English. And the heading is Masterpiece of Masterpieces, and her name is Carol Hemmerly from Switzerland. And I think this is interesting because of the way she comes to Proust. I want to talk about that. I had been intrigued by Proust since early age, for one of my favorite books is Golden Fizdale's Missia, and his name crops up all the time, too. And I don't know whether you know who Golden Fizdale were, the duo pianists, two gay duo pianists who were friends of Cage's and worked together and also worked with other people in the Cage circle. And they wrote a biography of Missia Sert, who was a great sort of bohemian figure in Paris. And it was a very popular biography. It was kind of bestseller about, I guess, 10 years ago or so when that book came out. So she says, I've been intrigued by Proust since early age, for one of my favorite books is Golden Fizdale's Missia, and his name crops up all the time in it. I bought the Scott Moncrief's English version in Paris over 10 years ago, and I know that many soi-disant more authoritative versions have come out ever since. Yet a few years ago, I read the version in French as organized, her English isn't all that good, as organized by Jean-Yves Tadier, possibly the best-known pundit, she means critic, on Proust's work to date. And I have to say, Moncrief's translation doesn't stray that far from the original. A la Recherche is to me the most important book in the history of literature. Compellingly philosophical, psychological, soul-searching, and aesthetic, no detail of life goes amiss. I'm alternately moved, stirred, and surprised at Proust's dexterity in describing the wide range of human emotions and the complexity of human interactions. He talks about art, love, jealousy, nostalgia, ambition, social climbing, politics, and you cannot fail to empathize with his prose and or finding new mood questions with each new reading of his work. His book is as relevant to life as life itself. Now, to come to Proust via the duo pianists Arthur Gold and Robert Fizdale, whose 1980 biography of the Polish pianist and society figure Missia Sert, she was a close friend of Diaghilev's and Cocteau's and other art world figures, was a charming but fairly ephemeral production, is nicely emblematic of the relation of high to low in our time. Carol Hemmerly first learns of Proust from Fizdale and Gold, whose affinity to Proust was surely not unrelated to their shared homosexuality. But once she actually reads the Recherche, she comes to find it the most important book in the history of literature. Each new reading, she suggests, raises new moot, and I think she means unanswerable, questions. Literature is news that stays news. Indeed, it seems that a whole new generation of readers is poised to take on this and other modernist novels and artworks. Immediately following Hemmerly, the Amazon site quotes Bob Riggs from Houston, Texas, writing on 4th December 2003. I just finished, writes Riggs, this is the most amazing thing I've ever read. The modernist masterpiece, that term of opprobrium, seems to be reasserting its erratic claims upon us, even as internet discourse, held in some quarters to be responsible for the loss of literary quality, is ironically reinforcing its very presence. Thank you.